Welcome to the sixth and seventh step workshop. Please help me welcome our first speaker for this panel, Jonathan from Austin, Texas.
Hey, good morning, everyone. My name is Jonathan Stone and I'm an alcoholic. And wow, it's so good to be here with everyone, seeing lots of familiar faces and you know, lots of new ones. I wanted to, first of all, really thank Myers for putting out Reflections of Step One and the importance of that by Paul F. That's one of the big game changers for me. Hold on, let me start my timer. Hang on, guys. I really have appreciated all of the speakers today. And I tell you what, getting on here with you guys really beats watching, you know, CNN or the nightly news 24/7. I wanted to tell you guys that one of my sponsees asked me what step I was talking on. And he said, I told him six and seven, and he said, "Oh man, someone must really hate you." And I was laughing because I think at least at the very beginning, that was my truth too. You know, our egos, my ego gets so wrapped up in kind of dissecting the, you know, the paragraphs that Bill wrote and what I'm going to put on in terms of my particular spin. And there's really not that much meat on the bone in six and seven in terms of academic instruction. More than any of the other steps, six and seven is experiential. And I tell you what, you know, I'm not the kind of guy, Mark Houston was my main mentor, and I'm not the kind of guy that's going to be able to push through things like six and seven and difficult amends or tough inventory just based on virtue, just based on wanting to be a better husband, a better father, a better sponsor. At the end of the day, and that's why I like Reflections on Step One so much, all of the steps, if I have a problem with any of the steps, I don't go back to the previous step. I go back to the first step. And, you know, I'm a member of other recovery groups, you know, especially since the pandemic hit. And I tell you what, there was a guy that posted yesterday, I don't know if you saw this, he posted three words: "I want a drink." And he was bombarded, you know, with people, well-intentioned people that were, you know, trying to throw, you know, good advice his way. But they consisted of things like this: don't drink no matter what. Play the tape all the way through. One guy even said, chug a lot of water. And I'm telling you guys, the reason that I love FOT so much is because what FOT stands for is why I'm sober today. My sobriety date's May 13th of 2008, but I started trying to get sober in 1995. And for 13 years, I listened to those well-intentioned people that really fed me a ton of misinformation. I'm not saying that just not drinking no matter what doesn't work for some people. But if the guy that posted, "I want a drink," has alcoholism like I do, has alcoholism like the vast majority of the people on this you know, conference do, the guys on page 21, we're really doing someone like that a disservice. And you know, the way that I was taught, since everything is related back to step one, I got to ask myself, can I correlate six and seven and continued kind of unmerited checks on my character defects to putting whiskey back in my body? And for me, this is the analogy that I came up with that really makes sense to me. You know, I'm so blessed to be in a wonderful, loving relationship with my wife of 18 years, Marsha, who you'll hear in a minute. But, you know, lots of the guys I sponsor, and I think lots of people these days, they go on social media. They go on online dating sites, and I don't even know what's right. Swipe left, swipe right. I don't know. I don't keep up with that. But if you can imagine, you know, you lead with a profile pic and a description. If I was to get on an online dating site and say, "Hey, I'm Jonathan. I'm a selfish, materialistic, jealous guy that doesn't like to ever admit he's wrong. I love to make assumptions. I'm so totally obsessed with how I feel. Please pick me. And, you know, common sense would say anyone with half a brain is going to, you know, run screaming for the hills away from that type of person. And to me, this is at the crux of how 6 and 7 are relating to me drinking whiskey again. I become unapproachable. No one wants what I have. No one asks me to sponsor them. I end up being totally alone. I get an emotional pain, and if I'm in emotional pain long enough, I'm going to drink again. So for me, there's a distinct correlation between 6 and 7 and drinking alcohol again. I wanted to lead, you know, with a couple of stories. The first story that I have has to do with my 19-year-old son, Wyatt. He's a freshman in college right now, but, you know, last year he was heading into his senior year in high school, and he had had a couple of brushes with alcohol and the law. And I sat him down the summer before his senior year, and I had a conversation with him, me and Marcia did. And we told him, look, buddy, and I still to this day don't know whether he's struggling with alcoholism or stupidity. But I said, if you continue to drink and get into trouble, I am going to intervene. We're going to send you somewhere. You're going to have to go to treatment or something. So he went over to his mom's on a summer trip last summer and got drunk on vodka. And she promptly, you know, God bless her, she had to put up with me for 10 years. She has a short fuse when it comes to alcoholic behavior. She put him on the plane and sent him directly back here. So me and Marcia sat down in the office with him and we let him know, you know, look, this is what we said. He wasn't really as contrite as I needed him to be, but you know, for the next 3 or 4 days, I batted around this idea in my head. I told him, I threatened him, I threw down the gauntlet. I know that he needs to go to treatment, but if I had sent him to treatment, it would have totally disrupted his whole high school career. He wouldn't have finished high school, most likely. If he is one of us, then hopefully he would have gotten to the point where he could write inventory and see things from my perspective, you know, at one point. But if he's not one of us, he might never, ever be able to forgive me for you know, disrupting his high school career. And so I sat there for 3 and 4 days knowing for sure that I needed to make sure that he respected me and that he feared the gauntlet that I threw down. But intuitively, it came to me that it just was not the right thing to do to send him to treatment. And so for those few days that I was battling, you know, inside my head, I obviously wasn't available to help many people. I was too wrapped up in myself. And then finally, like most of us are prone to do, after 3 or 4 days, I called my sponsor, Brian Percox, who you heard talk last night. And you could have knocked me over with a feather with his advice. I told him, I said, I just don't know what to do. I told him that he has to go to treatment, but I do not want to do that. Intuitively, it feels wrong to me. And he said, well, let me ask you this, Jonathan. Have you ever considered just sitting down with Wyatt and telling him you were wrong? And I thought to myself, that's the silliest thing that I've ever heard of. I mean, if you had listed, you know, 20 multiple choice answers of how to extricate myself from this thing, it wouldn't have been, how about admitting you're wrong? And so I prayed about it. I did some meditation with it. And the next day I brought him here into this office. And I told him, I said, look, buddy, I overreacted. It was something that I didn't think through. I was acting out of fear, and I was wrong to threaten you like that. I'm going to still, you know, leave in my wheelhouse the possibility of you going to treatment at some point, but I needed you to know that I overreacted because I was scared. And we had a big hug in here, and you know, my story would be a lot better if he was sober today. But he's still not. you know, he's still chipping away. And you know, but what I got to realize from that experience was that I was sitting here under the impression the whole time that my job was to teach him to fear his father. When really I needed the experience of admitting I was wrong, and Wyatt needed to see his dad apologize and say, "I'm sorry, son. I did it too quick." And he and I have really had more of an open relationship around his drinking since that time. You know, another story that I like to talk about happened a couple of years ago. Some of you guys have heard this story, but it involves Marsha. You know, I was at a point in my life where I had saved some money aside, and Valentine's Day was coming up, and I had asked her, you know, "Look, you can have anything you want. I'll get you some jewelry or some flowers, take you out to eat, you know, a weekend, whatever. Let me know what you want." And she sat there, she thought about it, and she replied with, "I know what I want." I said, "Okay, give it to me, whatever." She said, "I want you to write me a love letter." And I said to myself, hold on. First of all, that wasn't on the list of options. And then I repeated all of the different things that were available. And she stuck to her guns and wanted the love letter. Now, I don't know about all you guys, but I'm one of the guys that doesn't really enjoy being vulnerable and emotionally intimate. But I tell you what, that was another time where I got to sit there and pray, and I ended up writing that love letter. You know, I mean, put that on the list of things that Jonathan Stone won't ever ask for. But it was very, very important to her. And so I wrote her that letter, and, you know, being a selfish alcoholic like she is, not only did she ask me to read it out loud, but also at dinner. So I took her out to eat and read the letter out loud. She double dipped. But, you know, items like that, you know, the fear that drives every character defect that I wrestle with is what theoretically at this point we're on a different basis around. And, you know, the fear of me of being made fun of if I'm vulnerable or intimate, or the fear of looking small if I'm wrong. You know, the book tells me that at once I commenced to outgrow fear. It doesn't say that I'm going to be fearless. It doesn't say that I'm going to escape fear, but it allows me the action to take steps forward despite the fear. And, you know, those are just two examples, but I tell you what, guys, thoughts, and this whole community, the big book-based recovery that we've learned and been exposed to over the 12 years that we've both been sober has really been transformative. You know, Marsha and I caused a huge ripple effect with our using and drinking. But I like to believe these days that our recoveries have had even more of a profound ripple effect on our families and our loved ones. So thank you guys for having us. I look forward to the rest of the conference, and I really appreciated all the speakers that we've heard so far. So thanks, guys.
Thank you, Jonathan. Now I'd like to introduce Sarah from Denver, Colorado.
Hey, everyone. Good morning. My name is Sarah, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. And you know, it's funny that I'm talking on 6 and 7 this morning because I was just drowning in some defects this morning before I even got to this panel. I wasn't nervous about it until I logged in yesterday and saw that there are hundreds and hundreds of people participating in this, which is a beautiful thing. But of course, my head goes straight to fear, right? The old defect of what am I going to look like? Am I going to deliver the perfect message? How can I plan and prepare for this? And so this morning I had the perfect plan on how I was going to prepare and get all spiritual to come to this panel. I can tell you that none of that plan happened. You know, God had other plans for me because what that would have done is just kept me right up here instead of coming from my heart this morning. And that's what this conference is all about. It's about the language of the heart and us being of service to one another, using our experience, strength, and hope so that we can get closer to God. And what happened instead this morning, I had a bit of an issue with my computer, and my husband was fixing it, and he had a sponsee come over. And typically they run to the back to his office and they get going, and I don't really talk to them that much. But since we were out in the living room and my husband was helping me, I got to talk to him and his sponsee for a while. And that's what really grounded me. Having that sponsee over, seeing that they're about to go and meet one-on-one to share that experience, strength, and hope to get to recover together. And that's what I needed to see. That's what I needed to see. And once again, my higher power demonstrated that it knows much better what I need than what I think I need. I get to see that over and over and over in these steps. And like Jonathan said, for me, 6 and 7 are an experience. There is no definitive beginning. There's no definitive end. I just realized I didn't start my timer. They operate on a continuum all throughout my life, my sobriety, no matter where I am within the steps, because these defects that I have that are so ingrained and just woven into the fabric of my being have been there for a really long time. And those defects are what ultimately brought me to my knees and brought me into the program of Al-Anon. Because prior to, I wanted to blame everyone else for my problems, right? My problems were a symptom of them, the alcoholics in my life, my family, et cetera. And what I've gotten the clarity on in Al-Anon is that I am my own problem. I am my own worst problem. And unless I sit down with a sponsor and go through the steps and work through this with God, I'm not going to get any better. I'm not going to get relief from those character defects. And it's sometimes overwhelming to think about how deep those grooves go, right? Because those defects for me were developed in my childhood, living with active alcoholism, with alcoholism just pervasive in my home. And so, I did what I could to survive. I tried to be perfect. I tried to, get approval through performance, achievement, etc. I wanted to just stay quiet, not bug anyone, do whatever one wanted me to do, whatever they asked. And, then as I grew up into an adult, then I got really angry about it. I wanted to punish. I became a little bit hypocritical. My defects spanned a much wider continuum. And, when I came into Al-Anon and started doing the work, I got to see that these are just not working for me anymore. They are not, they help me survive, but they are more of a problem than anything else in my life today. And I've had really great sponsorship throughout the years, and they've all had different ways of kind of taking me through 6 and 7. But what I've always gotten to see is, here's the clear list of my defects from my 4th and 5th step, which is amazing. That fact-finding process with God, where I get to see the truth about what's blocking me from you and me from my higher power. And then I get to take an honest assessment of, am I willing to let those go? And I got to tell you, after every 5th step, I'm not always willing. There are always a few that I grapple with. But I get to see, okay, how is this not serving me? But then how is it still serving me? And sometimes I feel like those defects are still serving me in one way or another. The one that I've always struggled with is perfectionism. Because I've seen it benefit me when it comes to achievement and performance and, doing well at work and progressing in my career. But at the same time, God shows me how much harm it causes in my life on a regular basis. This is the one that shows up more often than the others. And it manifests pretty broadly in scope, right? It looks like me having black and white thinking, me being incredibly rigid, me wanting everyone to like me thinking that everything I say has to be perfect, and I have to have all the answers to any questions that come my way. And that is a really painful thing to lug around. That is a really heavy sheet of armor to wear incessantly. And so whenever I get to 6 and 7, I have to pause for a while to really honestly assess, am I willing to let go of these defects? Some of them are obvious, I don't want to be punitive. Great, God, take it. But when it comes to some of the other things around that control and perfectionism, I really have to get quiet and take some time to become ready. And that's okay. I can take all the time I need to become willing. And then when I get into seven, that's where the collaboration with my higher power and I really begins. Because, you know, there's a while where I thought that I was the one who was just going to work on these defects. I was going to do self-help. I was going to do the steps, go to meetings, whatever I could do to calm these down. And I remember one time I was coming out of a meeting and I spoke with this woman that I really respect who's been in recovery for a very long time. And she said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm okay. But I'm working on my character defects." And she said, "Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 Sarah, that is not what the steps tell us. Steps tell us that we ask God to remove those defects of character." And even though I've heard that in the program, it didn't really resonate with me until that moment. But I needed to get out of the way for God to come in and help me with those defects. Because the truth is, if I could fix myself, I would. I wouldn't need to come to this program. I'd be good on my own. Thank you very much. But I can't do that. I am powerless against this disease, and I need God to help restore me to sanity. And so that looks a number of different ways a lot of the time, but God always shows up.
So we were somewhere in the middle. Sarah was just explaining how she was talking to a lady about working on her character defects and was getting pulled to the side. And being explained that God works on the character defects. I'm going to just pick an arbitrary amount of time, about 7 or 8 minutes, because I think that's about right. And I'm just going to turn it back over to Sarah, and she can take it away. And thank you so much for joining us back.
Woo! Okay, that was fun. thanks for getting it back together. You guys are doing great. I was talking about this whole idea of working on my character defects versus letting God in to help me with them, and getting the heck out of the way, which I don't always do the best job at. And so, once that finally clicked for me, my 6 and 7 has been different. My experience with my defects and my relationship with God has been extremely different, because the truth is, I can't fix my own broken mind with my own broken mind. I need God to help me, restore me to sanity around those defects that block me from those around me and from my higher power. And so now, it looks a number of different ways. And more often than not, what it looks like is I can see the defect coming from far away, right? It's like a train just roaring towards me. And it's either going to get rerouted and go a different direction, it's going to head straight towards me, and we're just going to have a big, bad situation. And now when I see that train coming, I realize that I have more of a choice to engage with it or not, right? And I will not lie, there are times where I'm like, I don't care. I'm going to completely subscribe to this idea of being a hypocrite right now, or completely engage in my pride right now. Not my best moment, but progress, not perfection, right? But that pause also gives me the opportunity to say, nope, not today, not today, and ask God for the help to show up differently, to make a different choice. And so that's what it looks like today when I'm bringing God into that, and I get to have these moments where I learn from them and say, you know what, I didn't have to engage in that. I chose a different route. I feel so much better. And for me, that's what this whole program is about, right? I get to have these experiences with God, and they go into a case file, so that every time I have something new come up, I can go back to that case file and know that I am safe and protected. And that's what I get with this step and the rest of the steps as well. And, I'll close by telling 2 stories that I think are probably pretty relevant to this right now. I got a diagnosis in September for my health. It's a chronic diagnosis. I'm not going to die, but it was a really, really hard time for me to go through at the beginning of that, getting on and off medication, and enduring some trauma to my body and my mind. And so, I'm doing well now, but what's happening now is, as a result of that trauma, my hair is falling out. I know that might sound a little trite considering everything that's going on in the world today, but my hair just falls out, you know, left and right. And I'm so concerned, so scared, so frightened. And I'm doing everything I can to fix it. And I go and I see a dermatologist and she explains, you know, there is nothing you can do here. You just have to wait for this to play its course and you will be fine and it will all grow back. And this brings me back to what Jonathan was talking about, which is the fear that's at the root of all these defects, right? There's a line in some literature that says the chief activator of all my defects is the fear that I'm not going to get something that I want or something that I have is going to get taken away. And that is so true for me and all the defects that I experience. And I will tell you, I fought this, right? I was reading on the internet. I was obsessed. I was being mean to other people because I was so upset about it. And that is just my defect out in full force. And it wasn't until I got to a point where I got to see the harm that it was causing that I realized I needed to take a step back and truly get right with God around this, right? And that's another way that God engages me in this process. Sometimes I have to see how painful it is and how harmful it is before I am willing to go a different direction and I'm willing to have that defect taken away. And luckily, I've reached that point where I don't care as much. I'm not obsessing as much. But that obsession was just like the obsession around the alcoholic, just like the obsession around the drinking. And it's crazy to me how easily and how forcefully that can come back. And that's why I keep coming back to this program, right? I need to stay in check. I need to stay in check with my defects, spirituality, my relationship with God, that I don't cause that harm through my defects today. I can be happy, joyous, and free. And, you know, sometimes too, in this experience, I get to see how far I've come when I don't think I've come far at all. And God gets to show me that. I had an experience last week where I had had some trouble with an employee at work, someone on my team, and she wasn't performing and, you know, had to put all these performance agreements in place to get her up to speed. And she didn't like me a lot because of that. She ended up leaving the company, and this week there was a review on Glassdoor, which is essentially a review page for companies. You can say, yeah, you know, go work there. I loved it, or no, don't work there. And people just, you know, come out and tell the truth about their experience working for different businesses. And this week that employee posted one about me. And it was rough. It was rough. And it was very clearly about me. Anyone in our company could have put it together, given the language, the size of our company, and the fact that she was referring to me as a she. There aren't many female managers. And it made me really sad. It was really tough to read. And it's very clear that a lot of that is because she was disgruntled. But at the same time, you know, this tapped into my perfectionism. This tapped into one of my biggest fears, which is, am I going to look bad? Am I going to look bad to my boss, my team, my other employees? And I can tell you that even 6 months ago, this would have brought me to my knees and I would have been destroyed. But something happened differently this time. Like God came in and I just felt this presence of, you don't have to go to that today, right? You are safe and protected. And you know that this is not true. That all of this is not true. Listen to that. And I'm not the best at listening to that, right? I tend to be pretty hard on myself, pretty harsh. But I can actually access that. And for me, that was a really profound experience to not have the world and its people own me like it has before. And that's because of God. And that's because of my case file and the experience that I've had in this program. Things can be different. But I just have to put in the work, get out of the way sometimes, and ask for help. And that is something that I never learned to do growing up. I've only learned through this program. When I ask for help, that's where I feel the spirit, and that's where I feel God taking care of me. And I read recently that, you know, if my problems have brought me to prayer, then they've served a purpose. And so if that's all this is doing and it's keeping me closer to God, I'm super grateful for that. So thanks so much for doing this weekend. I love seeing our recovery communities come together. It's such a blessing and so great that we can be of service to each other and be in community during this rough time. So thank you for letting me be a part of it. And that's it.
Thank you, Sarah. Our final speaker for this panel is Marsha from Austin, Texas.
Hey guys, good morning. My name is Marsha Stone and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much, Devin, for putting this all together. It's just pretty amazing what you've been able to do and how many people are here enjoying the Fellowship of the Spirit. I'm really excited to talk about step 6 and 7. And Jonathan and I were laughing because I guess Jonathan and Sarah brought the heat so much that they crashed your server, Devin. So it's a hard act to follow, but I'll do my best. You know, I've been sober since May 6th of 2008, and that definitely wasn't the first time that I tried to get sober. I started going to treatment in 2002, and for the 6 years between 2002 and my sobriety date, I was in and out of treatment centers, in and out of detoxes, had a couple of stints in getting arrested and spending some time in jail, and, you know, just really being just dumbfounded because I really wanted to stop drinking and I really wanted to stop hurting the people that I love, but I just couldn't pull that off. And, you know, step 6 and 7 have a profound place in my recovery journey because in my last treatment center, it was a long-term gender-specific treatment center in Atlanta, Georgia. And I think I'd been there probably 3 or 4 months and I was sitting in an AA meeting. And I've been to tons of meetings while I was trying to get sober. I was what we talk about as a meeting maker. And I was sitting in a meeting and the topic that night was step 6 and 7. And I'm sure that I had heard those steps before. I'm sure that I had heard that topic before. But for whatever reason, that night I heard the speaker talk about that the purpose of step 7 was so that our character defects could be removed in order that we might go and help God's other kids. And I don't know why it hit me that way that night, but it was almost like a light bulb went off above my head. And I began to really have a deep understanding that this whole recovery process was not about me stopping drinking, but it was about me changing from the inside out so that I could help other people through my story of how I allow God into my life and that changed my life to the point that drinking was no longer a part of my life. You know, before step 3, we talk about that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem and that we're driven by all this fear. And then in step 7, we talk about, as Sarah was saying, how fear activates our defects of character. So that if fear is the driving force for defects of character and fear is the driving force behind the selfishness and self-centeredness, then I'm able to put those two things together and really understand that when I'm turning my will and my life over to the care of God, with will, I'm talking about my thinking, and with the other, I'm talking about my actions. So when we're talking about defects of character and the actions that we're taking based on fear and based on those defects and how they separate us from other people, it's clear that we're bound by the bondage of self and we're just completely unable to think about anything but the way we appear to other people, the way we want outcomes to turn out, and how that completely blocks us off from being able to do God's bidding. You know, every morning when I wake up, I hit my knees and I say the 3rd step prayer and I say the 7th step prayer. And I'm really focused on that word bidding, because if I'm going to go out and do God's bidding, then by default, what that means for me is I'm going to have to be cleared away from the defects that stop me from being able to do that. You know, in those 6 years when I was trying to get sober, I was, you know, I had a lot of good intentions. I intended not to drink. I intended not to hurt people. I intended to be a good wife and a good mother and a good employee. But I couldn't match my intentions with my actions. And so these days, if my intention is to go out and do God's bidding, but I can't match my intentions with my actions, And the thing that's keeping me from doing that is, in fact, my defects of character, are my defects of character. I don't know if my friends, Jonathan and Amy, are on this conference or not, but they were texting me the other day, teasing me, because step 6 and 7, they were saying, weren't very exciting steps because they weren't action steps. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, for me, they are, because the action is all internal, you know? And for me, you know, I never came into Alcoholics Anonymous for any other reason besides I wanted to stop drinking and I wanted my life to get better. But I can see really clearly now that God had a completely different plan, because when I'm changed from the inside out and I'm giving over my thinking and I'm giving over my actions to a power greater than myself, the results in my experience are nothing short of miraculous, because God always has a better plan for Marcia than Marcia has a plan for Marcia. You know, when I was thinking about this talk, for whatever reason, I was led back to what it looked like when I was first sober. I moved to Austin when I was about 8-9 months sober. And at that time, I wanted to get a service commitment, because my sponsor told me that being of service to others was the thing that was going to help when nothing else would, when it came to drinking again. I was really scared, you know. I had no history, no track record with staying sober for long periods of time. And I wanted to do everything I could to make sure that that was the result this time in sobriety. So I went down to this place called Austin Recovery, and I applied to bring an H&I into the residential treatment center. And they told me that I had to be sober for 1 year, but if I could get somebody to sort of shadow me and vouch for me, then I could come in on Saturday mornings and bring the message. So I met this woman, and they call her Princess, and she's a trip. She's a few years more sober than me, and she's still sober today. But I asked Princess Debbie if she would be my shadow to go in on Saturday mornings, and she said, yes, absolutely. Well, I refer to this as my sword and shield time of my recovery. I felt like AA had somehow issued me a sword and a shield, and it was up to me to, by God, get it right, do it right, make sure that everyone was paying attention and sitting up straight and listening to this message of recovery. So we go into this first meeting on Saturday morning, and Debbie, Princess Debbie, brought in these little stickers, and she had this glitter, and she was throwing glitter around, and she was saying, miracles, miracles in recovery, y'all. And she was giving everybody stickers to, you know, in my mind, defame their big books and all this stuff. And I was sitting up there, you know, white as a ghost, really just ready to deliver this message of depth and weight and let everybody know how it was supposed to be done. And they were obviously much more interested in what Princess Debbie had to say than what, you know, Marcia, the sheriff of Alcoholics Anonymous, had to say. So I went and called my sponsor after that. And I said, you know, this just didn't go right. This is a mess. They're not doing it right. There's all kinds of problems. You know, there's no discipline in that place. And she kind of laughed at me, and she said, you know, Marcia, is it possible that your fear is bringing out your character defects of rigidity and judgmental nature? And she was absolutely right, you know. It took me a while to really absorb that message and to really understand that it's the very things that I think need to be done that, as Jonathan was talking about earlier, are so off-putting to other people, the very people that I'm supposed to be helping because of my awakened spirit, right? It's funny, you know, when I was in treatment, I had this therapist, and I don't know if you guys can identify with this, but therapists, I believe, are put on this earth to kind of untangle this knot of delusion that we've been walking around with, you know. My spirit's awakened, but my thinking is still very tangled. And so we were talking about something that happened within our community. And she said, Marcia, what did you hear your community member say? And I don't remember the exact problem right now. It's obviously not that significant. But I told her what I heard her say. And she said, well, you know, you have this filter that tells you that your perception of events is right, and everyone else's perception of events is wrong. And I said, correct. You know, because that had been my way of thinking my whole life. If I think it, it must be true. And what recovery has taught me is that if I think it, it very well may be skewed by some defect of character that's, you know, has protected me for a long time, but now is a disservice to me and is hindering me from, you know, the evolution and the sort of the momentum of the spiritual awakening that we have in this process. Another thing that happened that I was brought to remember when I was thinking about this talk was Jonathan and I have a blended family. We have 5 children, and the oldest 3 children are all in their 20s now. And over the last 5 years or so, every single one of those kids has gone to treatment for alcoholism and addiction. And I've learned a lot along the way, but the very first time that the oldest one went to treatment, she went to this place in Tennessee. And, you know, I was really scared to send her there. I parented out of a lot of guilt and shame because of my own alcoholism. And sometimes still do today, but I think I'm getting better about it. But anyway, she went to treatment and she was there for about 24 hours. And her counselor called me and told me that she wanted to leave treatment. Now, I was hired by Mark Houston to run his recovery center when I was about 18 months sober. So I had had a lot of understanding about how alcoholism manifests and how, you know, codependency manifests and how to coach parents to keep their kids in treatment, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. This was my baby in treatment, and this was my baby that I hurt because of my own drinking. So the counselor calls me and tells me, you know, you got to say this, you got to say that, you've got to tell her that, you know, you're holding these boundaries and, you know, mm-hmm. all your financials cut off and she's got to stay there and you're not going to support anything but recovery and all these things. And I said, okay, got it. So my daughter calls me and tells me that, you know, they're being mean to her there and that the accommodations are less than stellar and she doesn't have enough to eat and whatever else she told me. And immediately all my training from Mark and from this counselor that had just called me was completely out the window. And I hear myself saying things like, it's okay, baby. I'm going to send you a plane ticket. You're going to be okay. We're going to bring you home. You're going to be better. We're going to love you back to health. Everything wrong. Why did I do that? Because my fear of what she was going to think of me, my fear that she would never forgive me for what I had done to her, caused me to go into this enabling mode and this real, you know, coddling and just, you know, taking actions that I thought would make her love me even if they hurt her. And that was absolutely nothing but my defects of character coming out and doing her a disservice. I'm happy to say that she didn't get sober that time, shocker, but she ended up going back to treatment and she's sober today. And so are my 2 boys that are underneath her because we have to learn these lessons. But you know, my best intentions, holding the right kind of meeting, you know, loving my children, you know, out of alcoholism. My best intentions are really nothing but these defects of character that are not allowing me to do God's bidding. When I can trust and rely on my higher power, when I can realize that this is not a popularity contest in Alcoholics Anonymous, but this is just an internal job for me to change, for me to become more the woman that God wants me to be, so that I can do my job, so that I can remember that my primary purpose is not to be a mom, not to be a wife, not to be an employee or an employer or a business owner or whatever. My primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics. And if I'm going to do that to the best of my ability, I've got to be willing to change, even when it's uncomfortable, even when it's unpopular, even when it makes me really scared or really sad or really angry. But again, you know, our literature tells us on page 100 that our life in God's hands was better than anything we could have ever planned. That's certainly my experience. And I guess I'll just keep on trying to do that. But thank you all so much for listening this morning. And again, thank you, Devin, for everything you've done to make this possible for all of us. It makes me feel a little emotional. We were supposed to have tech spots this weekend. And Jonathan and I will be there this summer in Colorado, God willing. This is a very, very sufficient substitute. So thank you all.
Good job, Sam.
Each of our panelists. This is all the time we have for this panel. Once again, thank you to all of our participants. And we will now have a 5-minute break to stretch your legs and get some water right here in this room. And we'll resume back in 5 minutes. By group conscience, the Fellowship of the Spirit Conference does not close each meeting with the Lord's Prayer. Instead, we encourage that this whole conference be treated with an attitude of continuous prayer, and we will then say the Lord's Prayer together at the close of this conference on Sunday. Please help me to close this meeting by joining hands for a moment of silence. Let us share our spiritual experience and strength with each other so that we can grow in greater understanding and love.